Welcome to the McGuffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themcguffman.com. We most recently talked about John Carpenter's The Thing. Before that was Baby Driver, 12 Angry Men, and Colossal. I've also written a bunch of things about topics, including like Enlightened, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, The Strokes, Lord, Jay-Z's new album, variety of things. So you can read those if you want, or don't. I really will not be moved either way. Follow us on Twitter at The McGuffin Man and tell your friends. All right, theme song.
Welcome to The McGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
We're back. Ready to get reeled down about, about some subjects.
I hope you got your sillies out before listening to this one.
I'm sure we'll find a way to make it way too silly a couple of times. But
yeah, okay, so we're talking about Prisoners, the 2013 Denis Villeneuve movie.
Correct.
Which is, I think I put some sort of description into this movie in an email form to you, but just a 2.5 hour sad fest about child abduction. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's what we're getting at when we said it's a bit of a heavy one again.
Not a lot of jokes.
I don't know if there's one intentional bit of comedy.
Yeah, I was going to say, I laughed a couple times, but I don't think they wanted me to. I actually think they explicitly wanted me not to.
I guess Detective Loki trying to get a cheaper bill at the beginning of the movie.
Sure. I guess, yeah. I guess that is this movie's answer to There's Something About Mary. You know, that is the rollicking comedy moment in this film.
Yeah, but yeah,
maybe drunk Terrence Howard playing trumpet, but all
oh
all
yeah,
in the
that's
first
true.
That was
minutes. That was for laughs. Yeah, but I mean, otherwise, this is a you know, it's an abduction movie. It's sort of a whodunit thriller. I guess it's not really a whodunit murder case, but we have two abducted children and fathers and police looking to sort of crack this case.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it starts with an animal being killed, and as we said, other than a few moments of levity, it doesn't really let up.
No, exactly. It is pretty morose start to finish, right down to one of our two leads maybe not living through the end of the movie. Yeah.
Right.
One has to believe that he does after everything we've learned about Loki, how he never got an unsolved case. You know? Nobody gets left behind with Loki. And the fact that he is clearly in the midst of starting to believe he is hearing hints of Keller. But yeah.
Yeah. And so Villeneuve's not really known for his comedy, is he?
No. I mean, the most comedic English language film he has made is Arrival, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what made you want to do Prisoners?
I mean, you've mentioned it a couple times, and you had never seen it. And I mean, I think we discussed maybe doing this when it first came out, and I kiboshed it just because I didn't think it was worth it. And Denis Villeneuve kind of, and I still kind of believe that. I just think Denis Villeneuve, now that he's three movies later, I just think it becomes more interesting for us to talk about because there's more of a directorial arc to look at. Because I do kind of, I mean, the first time we would have talked about this movie, just, you know, off the podcast as friends, I think I said something along the lines of I felt like it was kind of just imitation Fincher, and it's good, but it doesn't really, I don't know, it doesn't really hit the goals that it seems to be striving to attain, or to make me feel like everything comes together. I feel like this is a movie that has a lot of good ideas that all end up coming out half-baked. And there are things about this movie I love. There are things about this movie I absolutely hate. Like, hey, look, it's an Oscar winner who's in this movie for 3 minutes. I wonder if she's going to end up being the villain. You know, like that type of thing drives me crazy. I just don't know why people still do that. But I guess also I understand it's a hard thing to find a workaround for. But yeah,
because I mean, you have so much depending on this performance that it's hard to find someone who's that age who just is still undiscovered, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. But I mean, and also there are just so many fewer female character actors than there are. Who's the guy that played the Zodiac Killer in Zodiac? Arthur Lee Allen is the name of the actual character, but that type of actor. There are just so many fewer women that have sort of character actor careers. And Melissa Leo is kind of an example of a woman that would be that type of actress if she hadn't recently won an Oscar right before this movie came out. So I recognize that's a difficult thing to work around, because if the killer had just come out of nowhere, or sorry, the kidnapper had just come out of nowhere at the end of the movie, I would have been like, well, that's shit too, you know? It's a no-win situation, but I just think there are some things in this movie that are just a little too on the nose, and that combined with some of the more half-baked elements of the movie and some things that kind of bother me about the movie, like the what we just talked about, the twist that is a non-twist. I don't know, it just sort of, it never all comes together for me. And also, I remember the first time I watched this movie, when it cuts to black, I rolled my eyes. Like, I physically remember the sensation of actually rolling my eyes instead of just being like, well, that's too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you say it's wannabe Fincher, is it just so clearly wanting to be Zodiac, even by having our same,
Gyllenhaal,
I guess, yeah, as the one trying to crack the case in the middle of it all? You know, other than it being a pretty dark and heavy movie, which Fincher often likes to live in that world, is that what it is, or is it more things about his style that you see in this?
It's more the style, and also that it's just about the darkness living underneath American life. But I guess that description sounds more like I'm talking about a Lynch movie. But stylistically, Villeneuve really takes a lot from David Fincher, and also changes it. You know, like there is a pace that Fincher moves at that Villeneuve moves in the absolute opposite speed. You know, he's just a very slow, patient filmmaker. Whereas Villeneuve and Fincher both have very composed shots, and every frame of their movies are gorgeous, but there's just a totally different speed their movies work at. You know, Prisoners is a much more patient movie than pretty much anything David Fincher has ever directed. And I don't mean that as a knock on Fincher. I'm obviously one of the biggest Fincher fans in the world. But yeah, there are elements of their style that are similar, but I don't think they make movies in the same way. I just sort of felt like after I saw this movie, when I say imitation Fincher, I meant it both as a compliment and as something that never quite gets to the heights of something like Seven, which I think is also just a very bleak movie with a relatively simple story that's told in a very interesting way and very stylish way. But I just feel like something like Seven, I get so much more out of it, you know?
Yeah, it's derivative, but it's derivative of a style that you like.
Exactly, you know?
It seems odd for you to complain. I mean, I know you're not complaining that he's a patient filmmaker, but that seems like something you typically do enjoy.
Oh, the pace of this movie is absolutely not the thing that I dislike about it. You know, and the cinematography is fantastic, as I mentioned. The pacing is not something I dislike in any way. And also, like, when I say patient, normally it's code for slow. You know, like when people say I also don't feel like this movie feels like a 2.5 hour movie, which it technically is, you know, if we're judging by things like minute count. But I just feel like it moves quicker than the actual duration of the movie, you know.
Yeah,
which I think is you know, it's something that seems patient while you're watching it, but it also feels like if you start this movie at 6, it was over at 8 and not 8:30, you know.
Yeah, and in speaking with that pace, I mean, it's a movie that lingers on a shot or lingers on a reaction or a character just experiencing an emotion rather than chasing just the action points, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, the closest thing to a straight-up action scene that there is in this movie, excuse me, is the combination of the I mean, we can't even call it a shootout between Melissa Leo and Jake Gyllenhaal at the end, but them firing guns at each other, and then Loki taking the kid in the car to the hospital, which is a fantastic sequence. But yeah, that's the, I think, closest thing we have to an action scene.
Yeah, there's the foot chase after the candlelight vigil, but
yeah,
you know, there's kind of one moment of contact between them, and yeah, it's mostly exactly. chasing around the backyards.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the most important question is, who's the real prisoner?
Ooh, aren't we all, though? I think that's the... That's the important answer. No, I want to know what you think about this movie, though.
I kind of felt that... I think a lot of the things that you think... Like, I think that this movie always takes itself extremely seriously. Well, and
that's definitely true.
Yeah, I think that there's no... I don't know. There are certain terms that when people talk about these movies that seem to, that do bother me, and... I think there is a time and a place for an extremely heavy movie. I mean, it's a movie about two, I don't know, 8-year-olds being abducted, and not only just the abhorrent nature of that, but the effect that that has on the people in these children's lives. You know, it's rightfully a subject to be dealt with a lot of gravitas, but... It is so humorless that it really is. It's so bleak and it's so humorless that it's, if you're not totally all in on it, so many things that, you know, when they swing for the fences and miss, that strikeout does look really bad.
Yeah.
And I think that it's the clearest with Hugh Jackman, who, you know, I imagine has kids and thought about that the experience of what it would be like to have your children abducted, and, you know, funnel that into the performance, which is a completely reasonable thing to do. But yeah, I think that misses a few times. And when you're as I said, when you're going that hard and it doesn't quite fire on all cylinders, to continue adding metaphors to the description, it just misses. And I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal, who we've kind of talked about, I feel like just looks at this character that is interesting and, you know, decides to make two choices and then play it the way that he'd play everything, plus these, you know, plus a facial tick and a button. And it's some of that just misses. And I think overall it is good. I think it's worth a watch. But I see what you mean as well. I think I probably like this more than you do, judging by the way you've talked about it. But yeah, it's not my favorite movie like this. And it's not my favorite Denis Villeneuve movie. And it's not my favorite Jake Gyllenhaal movie or my favorite Hugh Jackman movie. So yeah, I guess that's where I land on it critically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, this is, I think... quite obviously a good movie. It's just sort of, we are judging it, I mean, anytime we pick a movie to sit down and talk about it for an hour, we're judging it on a different scale than if it's just like, you know, you're visiting me for the weekend and like, hey, let's watch this movie, you know, like,
let's watch Snake Eyes again.
Every day of my life if I could.
But this movie wants to be thought about in that.
That is true. I agree with that, but I also think that you know, there's a place for a movie like this that it wants to be thought about like that, but it's also worth just watching as, I don't know, I do find this a very enjoyable movie to watch. Also, I mean, mostly for craft-based reasons. Like, I just think the craft behind the filmmaking is fantastic.
Yeah, and surprise, it's nice to look at. No, just by the person behind the camera.
No, we haven't mentioned him. Mentioned Roger Deakins yet either, but he is the
freaky deaky himself.
Yeah, still Oscarless, but still fantastic. He'll get it for Blade Runner, though. I think it's his apologies coming. I don't know. It's like, I really enjoyed watching it when I watched it free of any sort of need to analyze it for a discussion with you. You know, I just sort of watched it as a cop and kidnapping sort of movie, and enjoyed it. And it's just sort of like, when we start looking at it this lens, looking at it under this lens, is when it really starts to fall apart, you know.
So what misses for you then? Like, I think that it's not it doesn't sound like it's a lack of ambition by any means. It's, so what do they try to do that they don't do, or what do they try to do that they do way too hard, I'm guessing, is probably a common complaint of yours.
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm like, it seems like this town, well, I don't know if we ever get the name of the town. I know it's in Pennsylvania. But it seems like this town, like everybody that lives in it has been like personally attacked in their home in some way, just through the nature of how few characters we really get introduced to. And that's, you know, we also don't really know the population of the town. I'd believe anything numbers wise. I'd also believe this is a suburb of a bigger city. But that we get introduced to so little outside of the core group of characters, I think really gives it the feeling that this is a town where everybody has been personally attacked. And that's something that I think really contributes to the more negative aspects of this movie. And the thing that continually jumps out at me, we'll talk about Jake Gyllenhaal later, but the thing that continually jumps out at me is what you're saying about Hugh Jackman, is that he really goes for it a lot of the time. And sometimes that's it's like outwardly terrible, like to the point where I laughed out loud. I made an allusion to this earlier, like the part where he's yelling at his son in the hallway of their room after he's just given his wife some pills and he's gonna go continue to look for their daughter. Like he's just screaming at his kid, he's like, you have to be strong, and he like grabs him by the neck, like,
yeah,
objectively terrible acting, you know, like I just think it's so but I mean I can't say objectively terrible because people have quote unquote praised his performance in this movie, but I just think it's so, anytime I see a scene like that, the only thing I'm hearing is give me an Oscar, you know, it doesn't matter what the character's saying, that's all I hear over and over again. And especially when you grab a character by the face or the neck and wipe away a tear or whatever, it's just like, I get it that this is a very difficult situation, but like, take a step back, you know?
No, I think you're absolutely right.
You're out Gyllenhaaling Gyllenhaal right now.
No, I think you're right when you say that kind of everyone we meet in this movie has that. I mean, I think that, as I said earlier, this is a subject matter that, you know, is so weighty, and, you know, a certain reverence has to be given to it, because, you know, obviously it happens more than it should, but the idea of a child being abducted like this is so incredible. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's so incredibly tragic when it does. And then, like, you can't even find a dead body in this movie that hasn't killed 16 kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just, so that priest, you know, Gyllenhaal kind of, Loki kind of references the fact that, you know, in his boys' school, there was some pretty untoward thing happening to children. Melissa Leo's character, Mrs. Jones, Alex Jones has undergone it. And a movie where we have very few characters' names that we learn. Oh, and, you know, the hoodie guy, the guy from Dark Knight.
Yeah.
You know, he's dealt with it too. And it really does take some of the weight away of it from it and make it a little ridiculous when,
well, and also find, sorry, continue.
Just when you can't find a character that has undergone it. I'll agree that this is something that happens too often, and, you know, perhaps is underreported and not discussed enough because it is such an unpleasant subject, but just the ratios we're dealing with here are a little absurd.
Yeah, absolutely. And also Keller's father killed himself as well, committed suicide when he was 46. So you've also got that, which we don't learn until much later in the movie, but it's another way tragedy has touched one of our few characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So Jake Gyllenhaal, I mean, we talked about it a little bit. I always go, especially in the last year, I've gone back and forth on Jake Gyllenhaal, like whether or not he's a good actor. And I think his last name, I remember hearing this in an interview, his last name actually means work hard, and which is so fantastic. And because that's always how I feel about him. Like, you can always tell he's putting so much work into his performance, and I think he prides himself on that. And sometimes the way that you show that doesn't necessarily help you, you know, and the, like the ways that he's doing that in this movie that we can are the most obvious are the top button. Like he's trying, he's so so afraid of or so wanting to protect himself from this world that he can't even let a button go undone, you know, like he's got to suit up as best as he can because you need as much armor as you can out in this world. And also the fact that he the hard blinking that he does just sort of conveys that you know, he's a person that looks at such horrible aspects of the world that like his reflexes are trying to stop him from doing it, and yet he must fight on, you know. And that's
Everything's so labored, like the thing that you do 10,000 times a day and don't even think about has to look difficult for him.
Exactly. And those are both ideas that like I get and appreciate on paper, but you know, I could see like me as faux Jake Gyllenhaal acting coach, and he's like, I'm gonna try this idea, and me thinking like, yeah, that's a good idea, that looks good, and then him actually physically doing it, I'm like, no, cut that out. that's gonna annoy people all movie. And like, you know, we're both in agreement. He is fantastic in Nightcrawler. Nothing's going to change that. But that's the perfect kind of movie for him to try way too hard, you know? Whereas this movie, we've talked about it so much already. It's so patient and restrained. And then Jake Gyllenhaal is like the bull in this metaphorical China shop, just walking around doing way too much all the time. And, I think I like Jake Gyllenhaal. I know I like him in some movies. I don't think I like him in this movie.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I like, even Jake Gyllenhaal, no matter what the movie is, if he's doing too much, I think I would still prefer him to pretty much like anybody, you know, than other than like three different actors, you know, because I just enjoy watching him perform. But sometimes he performs so outlandishly that it hurts the movie a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, there's snakes in this toolbox too. Oh, more snakes in this one.
I mean, he eventually he is proven right, because the last one is just a notebook. But yeah, that scene is I will say creepy, just because everybody is kind of creeped out by snakes except for Loki apparently. But like that scene works because we were all raised on Raiders of the Lost Ark and are ipso facto kind of afraid of snakes.
No one was afraid of snakes before that movie.
No. Snakes were like dogs, but pre 1980. Like they were the household pet.
No biblical precedent to be afraid of snakes.
Exactly. Nothing at all. But yeah, that's it's a scene that's good, but also is kind of silly in that he just keeps opening these things and that scene goes on for so long. And at some point he has to be like, oh, what if one of these snakes is poisonous? I am not a snake expert. Presumably not a snake expert.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania cop. You know, I don't think they double as snake experts. Double as John Voight in Anaconda.
Next week, by the way. no, I actually, the animal theme is one that I really do enjoy throughout this movie. And I think it's one that, you know, we kind of joked about the snakes. Maybe that's a little much, but I like the opening with the deer. And, you know, there's this obvious theme of, you know, hunting, you know, looking for the abductor or attempting to get the truth out of Alex Jones. And I do like that a lot. I think that's done well. You know, we start with the hunting of the deer between Keller and his son. And it's, as I said, you know, pretty adversarial, just this idea of hunting, but even discussions taking place inside the daughter's empty rooms. We see, you know, it's not crazy. The little girl's room's going to have some cute stuffed animals, just some cute pictures. But I think Deakins does a nice job of framing some of these shots, nice and symmetrical, and keeping that notion present without hammering it over the head too often. And that's something I actually did enjoy quite a bit. And there's a long list of just animals in the background or ways that they're discussed that I think isn't too ham-fisted for the most part.
No, I agree. The things I like the most about this movie are the way the movie approaches nature, the way the movie approaches the home as well, which is kind of what you're talking about as well. And just those are the things I really like, because those are the things that no character ever screams about, you know? And Yeah, the stuff that goes over the top is the stuff where people are explicitly discussing themes, but nobody's ever explicitly saying we're the deer in a forest and they're hunting us, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and even just the small shot of like slowly zooming in on a tree in their front yard, it's kind of just an artsy shot with no, you know, around no dialogue, not really forwarding the story anymore, and it's just this slow little zoom, and it's tiny, and I really liked it a lot, and I don't know, maybe that's cheap, but I enjoyed it.
Nope, that shot's fantastic, and it's fantastic because they set it up, because I think you're talking about the shot of Viola Davis and Terrence Howard's house, right? Right. During yeah. Thanksgiving dinner. Yeah. So that shot's great because it's sort of the inverse of the opening shot where we get the, to politely correct you, it's not a zoom. It's a sort of push in and pull back. Like the,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the camera's physically moving, not the lens.
Oh, yeah.
So the opening shot is the pullback of the shot of the deer and, Keller and his son hunting it in the forest. And, you know, we see them hunting, and then we go have this Thanksgiving dinner. We see everybody getting all comfortable. The parents admit to being drunk. You know, they're really like letting their guard down. And then we get this reminder shot from outside their house of this tree, like the sort of push in on the tree, like to sort of be like somebody is walking towards this house in a threateningly patient manner, you know, because the camera moves so slowly. It's very clearly moving, but it's moving slowly. And it's just meant to show us that by letting their guard down even for a second, they now become the deer in the forest. And I mean, that's incredibly dour, but and paranoid. And I am very curious to know what the security system is like on Denis Villeneuve's home, but like it's a great moment, especially since it comes after like just the most familial sort of thing that we see in this movie, you know, because nothing tragic has happened yet, or nothing that we know about that's tragic has happened yet.
Right, nothing tragic has been depicted yet. No. Yeah, I to compare those two shots, I mean, we have this deer in nature, you know, it looks like it's at home in the wild, and then we pull out and we see the end of this gun, and then we see the people, and then, you know, the shot gets fired, and it's this just this idea that, you know, the deer has its place, but it lives kind of within this human world, and in that context it can quickly become a victim. And you know, the other way is that we see this very domestic situation. You know, they're watching football and they're having dinner and
watching, you know, a Lions game in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know. That's why I thought it was going to take place in Detroit at first. But yeah.
I think my take on that is just that family might just be from Michigan. You know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then we have this, then we, you know, it's that same idea reversed or taken back a step. Sure, you have human society now when you have houses and heating and home-cooked meals and, you know, this very friendly situation, which is so apart from nature, apart from the harsh realities of, you know, survival out in the woods. But it's still animals. You know, humans are just still these animals who are willing to do things to each other and always put themselves first. And, you know, your situation can change just as quickly as that deer's did. You know, that deer didn't realize that shot had been fired before it got hit. And they're in the situation where they don't realize where their daughters are. And, you know, they've already become, their family's already kind of become victims or about to be, you know, affected by this victimhood in such a way. And that's a little small shot of the tree, I think, coupled with that opening, conveys that very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that they happened so close together that you know, we didn't really have time to even forget about the opening shot yet. I think, you know, it's a very, very good moment in the film, you know.
Yeah.
One of the many details in this movie that works, because I think this movie does a lot of interesting things with the small details, and it's just sort of the big things that don't work.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Yeah, I mean, I think Deakins has a lot to do with the things that we both seem to like from what we're saying, and the moment where they walk away from the RV as well, and we have them kind of framed with the two older kids and the two younger kids paired up, and it's this nice symmetrical shot, and it just looks like a family moment, and then we get to see more and more inside the RV, and it the same thing. It goes from this personal experience of a moment, or an even thoughtless experience of a moment, to the voyeuristic look, the way that someone looks down a gun, the way that someone hides behind a tree and looks at a house, and the way that someone looks out a window and sees you living your life in a way that you would never think about putting any attention into that moment, but someone else could be, and someone else clearly was.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of good examples in this movie of shots where the thing that you wouldn't think, what you wouldn't expect to be in focus, is the focus of the shot. Like right after that first scene where Keller and his kid are hunting in the forest, we get the shot of the deer in the back of the truck, and the focus of the shot is actually on the raindrops on that back window, and we can just see the deer, the corpse of the deer, in the background, and it's saying that, like, it's this nice way of conveying that this death is has already happened, but there's still like something that is coming down to attack you. Even though it is just a light rain shower, it's still these natural elements that are dangerous to humans if you don't have the proper shelter, you know, eventually over time. There's a nice shot of I think the girl leaving their home right before they go to Thanksgiving, and the focus of the shot is the cross on Keller's hanging from Keller's rearview mirror in his truck. And around this time, there were a lot of it was like very in vogue to shoot like a close up of, like, there's a scene towards the end of Breaking Bad where right before I think people are coming in on Walt's like winter hideout, wherever that was, and there are just shots of like close-ups of picnic tables and like FBI agents or DEA agents running behind it, and they're out of focus, and it was just sort of like this interesting way to do a shot, but it didn't really convey anything. It was just like, we're just not going to do things the way they're normally done, but with the way the Deakins and Villeneuve do it in Prisoners, it feels like it sort of adds an element, you know, because religion is so present in this movie, for reasons that my general ignorance towards religion just didn't catch on to. And just like the weather, I think is prevalent in this movie. Those drops of rain matter, because this is a movie that takes place in the dead of winter in rural Pennsylvania, and it almost never snows. And I think I think the real reason behind that is because they happen to have a warm period of weather when they were shooting this movie, but I think the unintended consequence is it sort of makes sort of has this very subtle, maybe even crazy on my part, global warming idea behind the movie, in that our world is eventually dying too, you know, like even the thing that you live on is not safe, you know.
Yeah
because we will eventually all burn up in lava.
Yes.
That was a long walk for a small point about details, but
no, I think, as I said, I think the details really add so much to this movie, so mm-hmm. I'll allow it.
Yeah, and also just like the I think the way some of the cops talk, I really enjoy, in a way that doesn't exist in a lot of movies, like Loki's boss, who he seems to have like a mildly contentious relationship with.
I'd say so.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we've seen him play that guy, that exact character, in like 40 different movies. He's always fantastic at it. But like the way that he says stuff like, we're just cops, we're janitors, like you're gonna lose some. What's the other one? Oh, and just like also little procedural stuff, like towards the end when they're I don't even know what their title would be, but the detectives are looking at Melissa Leo's property, and he's the leader is sort of saying like, all right, let's cover these up, it's gonna snow soon. Just that type of, that thing that is clearly would be a part of the job, like if evidence is about to get snowed on, you should cover up the evidence with a tarp. But it's just something that I would never think about. And I just enjoy that element, that very detailed element being a part of this movie.
Yeah, I like them turning off their radio for some reason, too.
Yeah, that's true. And you get a dash of Tom York in the movie, too.
Oh, yeah, that's why I liked it.
But yeah, those details are the things that I think make this movie something that is still worth podcasting about, even though we both kind of don't like the big things about this movie, you know?
Yeah, and I was happy that they didn't get too deep into that contentious relationship with his captain there. They just say, go fuck yourself. And I just didn't want it to be one more thing about a dark history between them with, you know, some heavy thing that happened in their childhood. Like, I just like to think that they're people who just don't get along and happen to work together.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They don't get they don't dislike each other enough to either quit their job that they seemingly enjoy. Mm-hmm. But they have some differences.
Yeah, exactly. And just a couple other little details that I enjoyed that sort of touch on points we've already discussed. But when Keller is in his truck, I forget when this is, but there's this prolonged wide shot of him in his truck, and there's just all of the glass in the truck is just reflecting the trees around him, and it just looks like he is physically in this, despite being obviously in a truck. It looks like he is in a forest somehow. It's a very gorgeous shot, and they hold on it for so long that we're supposed to take some meaning out of it, and that's just sort of a way of showing that he's just in this forest. And I think the other moment about the home that we haven't touched on is that he is torturing Alex Jones in his old home, like his childhood home, which is also where his father committed suicide, you know. And it's just sort of the home he used to live in is now dilapidated and depleted, and everything erodes, basically, you know. Like, there is no true safe habitat for you to be in.
Yeah. So something that you mentioned earlier about maybe that there's, when you're speaking about the trees there, maybe or in details in general, maybe having less significance than they might have intended to, or maybe you're just reading into it too much. Did you think that this was saying anything about the contemporary America that this was made in 2013?
I don't know, because I was trying to think. I was trying to think about it because I mean, it feels like it would be now if it came out now, you know, like it would pretty obviously, I don't know, it wouldn't be that hard to come up with the ideas, you know, that
like
we're
what?
All, like we're all deer in the forest of a post-truth world where nothing, it feels like nothing kind of makes sense right now. Like the leader of America is just outwardly lying constantly. Obviously lying, as opposed to at least playing coy about their lies like most presidents do. But I don't know, it's just sort of the about 2013, I just couldn't think of something that is as dark as this movie is, you know. And there we're obviously supposed to think about America because the Star Spangled Banner gets discussed, and that Keller is like an objective or like a fan of the song, you know. And so they want us to think about America in some capacity, but I don't have a take.
Okay. What yeah, because well, no, he just between his favorite song being Star Spangled Banner and his favorite artist being Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. And you know, the hunting and so many things that kind of denote a good middle class American. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he wears plaid a couple times in this movie.
Oh, he wears nothing but plaid.
Yeah, like, is that
there's
true?
There's always at least one plaid garment. Like, he's sometimes got a kind of a workman jacket on or something, mm-hmm. but under it, there's usually a plaid shirt.
Gotcha.
I mean, no, for now, I mean, that's one of the weird things, too. I mean, I think that this presidency has kind of colored everything, and I think we've tried avoiding talking about it on this podcast. It really hasn't come up that often.
Because everybody talks about it all the time, and I don't think we have anything new to add to it, you know? And
And it's still so new that by the time a feature film is made about it, we're still not in that time period, right?
Yeah, I will say, like, the things that are going to happen, like, in film that end up sort of feeling like they're about, like, Beatrice at Dinner is has been talked about as this this is the Trump movie, you know. And everybody that talks about that is 100% right. It's like borderline uncanny how well that movie represents. I mean, some of it is, you know, just sort of, I think Mike White just felt like Donald Trump was going to win, so he made a Donald Trump movie. That's not, you know, it's not the the Prisoner's version of Donald Trump, where it's like beating you over the head with things. But that is a movie that feels like a very post-Trump movie, despite the fact that it was probably shot last summer. So the things that are going to come out now that feel like they're about this presidency either happened by accident or by somebody properly predicting that Donald Trump was going to become president and just continue being Donald Trump. So yeah, I don't know. It's harder to find it in film, basically.
Yeah, just because the lag of how long it takes to make a movie like this. And I just see this, you know, just watching it now. You know, the Keller Dover character is this, you know, as we said, kind of like a white middle class male, and just his basement, you know, it's, I don't know if we're supposed to get the feeling that he's preparing for the worst, or he's kind of like wishful thinking the worst. You know what I mean? Just this, the amount of ammunition and the amount of food and the gas mask and things like that. I think you could color it to the you know, the white working class male that people kind of blame for Donald Trump getting elected. To what degree that's true or not, I think is irrelevant. But I think that it's obviously not that, just because this movie came out in 2013. And so I do want to divorce it from that idea, just because of the impossibility of the nature of that. But just to talk about Dover as someone who has seemingly this moral high ground, you know, he's a very religious person, and he's someone who, you know, he prays, but I think that there's kind of this regression, the way that it reminded me when you brought it up earlier about him, you know, living in this old apartment of his father's, you know, Ralph's grandfather, and just this idea that he wants to be a good father and, you know, to his son, and also be the father that, you know, an abducted daughter he feels needs at that point in his life. And I think that if he were to talk about his politics, maybe he would say that, you know, torture is a bad thing, but is willing to do it when it becomes his problem. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's true of a lot of people. There's just this sort of apolitical process when you become a parent. You know, they would say that, you know, we shouldn't be able to tap people's phones or break into their house without a warrant, even if we're pretty sure that they're the ones who are the perpetrators of whatever particular crime. But as soon as it becomes your child, that kind of goes out the window. And I just don't get the sense that Keller is a bad person until something like this happens. But the idea that there's something below the surface, you know, just below the ground, in this case, his basement, the prepper thing, you know, just that he is prepared for something bad to happen, but do you ever get the idea that he kind of wants something bad to happen in order for him to be able to release this part of his personality that maybe he has to tamp down the rest of the time?
I wouldn't say I get the feeling that he wants this to happen or wants something like this to happen, because obviously if he wants some sort of situation where he can be the hero, he wouldn't choose one where his very young daughter's in danger. But like, I just don't think enough of the movie happens before tragedy strikes that I'm able to get a real good feel on him without projecting, you know. I think everything that you're saying is right, and especially the him being prepared for, like, him having a shelter in his basement that we learn later on definitely sort of indicates somebody that is at least a little bit paranoid about the world around him. I don't know. I don't remember thinking in the first 20 minutes, man, this guy's just ready for tragedy and is begging for it to happen. It's just so he can feel like he has purpose, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true, because I can't think of the one thing in the first bit before the kids go missing that really speak to that. I mean, he's prepared, and I wouldn't want to make it sound, I mean, sure, it is maybe a little paranoid, but you know, the idea of being this super providing father who is ready, it has all these contingencies planned if things do go bad. I think that there's something very admirable about that, but I think I see it in the way he treats Alex Jones. I know you're not saying that that was, you know, right by any means what he does. But him, the way that he takes this place and then continues to construct inside of it, the way that he builds that, you know, the closed in shower for him. I think once we see him take his tools, you know, in every sense of the word, literally, you know, his power tools, but also his knowledge and his ability to keep a secret and his ability to do the hard things in life if it means something good coming of it. I think that's when we start to see his true self. And I think that also ties in with the religious stuff. I mean, we see, as you said, he's got the crucifix, he's got the Jesus fish on the back of his truck. The movie opens with him praying. You know, he seems to be a very religious person, but I think that it starts to cross the line of being someone who reveres God to being kind of someone who becomes God. And as I said, if you were to ask him what his opinions on torture or, you know, false imprisonment and kidnapping to a certain degree are before this happened, you would get a fairly normal answer. But for him to do this, even when pushed to it, I think reveals a certain kind of person. And when he builds Alex Jones, the, you know, kind of closes him in the shower, I see the religious tones in it, but the religious tones gone askew. I don't think this is what all religious people want to do, but we see the idea of religion gone awry a few times in this movie. We see Keller do it. We see the priest reveal that he's killed because of his religious convictions. We see Mrs. Jones used to be a religious person, but then cancer took her kid, and now she kind of has sort of jiu-jitsued that to turn it against other people. And what I was saying with the close-in shower, I get this confessional vibe that he has put himself in the place of the priest, in the place of organized religion, and wants Alex Jones to confess to him. And I think at a point he realizes that's wrong, and it's when he can't get through the prayer part where he asks for forgiveness and allows himself to forgive other people. That's when he realizes how far he strayed from the religious path that he claims to value.
Yeah, and like those were all things that I didn't really think about. Also, just because you have more of a background of having gone to church as a child than I did. Yeah. So these are things that a lot of times when a movie has heavy religious themes, I miss entirely. But I agree very much with you, and I think that's a good explanation. And also just visually, the way that they show the once Alex is trapped inside that confessional booth, as you've called it, it's even shot in a way that pretty much every confessional booth scene in any movie ever is shot, in that the camera is looking at Alex straight on. It's just there's so little light coming in that we don't really get a good look at him. We only really see his eye, and it's just because that's not a conventional confession booth. It's one that's been built specifically to have as small of a hole as possible. And but still, it does look like the shot is meant to be seen as a confessional booth, you know, just the design of it.
Yeah, and it isn't one. I think that's why it looks that way. That's why it's obscured by this darkness.
Yeah, and, yeah, exactly.
And just this notion that at that point, you know, Keller's playing this godlike figure, and he acts like he's all knowing and all powerful, and he just wants Alex to confess, but we don't know this at the time, but Alex does not have anything to confess. And it shows the error in his ways that he's looking for this bit of information that he'll never receive because he can't.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I guess we should end on talking about the ending of the movie. I think we can both safely, I assume you feel like Loki finds Keller, right?
Yeah. And I'm glad we don't see it, but I think it's fair to say it happens.
Yeah. He just, like, everything we have learned about him to this point in the movie just shows us that he's not going, because, like, that's a real moment of, I think what the movie wants us to think about is, because we see him physically the first time that he hears the whistle, see him shake it off, you know, and it's just like, oh no, I'm just hearing things. And then he hears the whistle again, and I think the ending point of this movie is meant to see to say that if you think you hear something, you probably hear something. And I think that's just, like, even it's like doubling down on darkness in this movie, because I think it's supposed to, even though the what is going to happen because of this is Keller being rescued by Loki, and he'll have to go to jail, but he at least won't die. I can't imagine. I mean, Pennsylvania probably doesn't even have the death penalty, but just that this, like, if you hear this small noise, the small repetitive noise, it's not paranoia, it's there's really something out there. And I just think that's so, I mean, the way I just described it sounds way too X-Files, but it's just, I don't know, that's just, like, somehow, even for this movie and how dark the whole thing has been, it's just so, like, unapologetically dark, you know?
Yeah, well, it's, I think if we had the scene of him being pulled out, it would lighten it up. But I think you're right. Like, there is, it is showing someone about to be saved, but somehow that's the pessimistic version of the ending.
Yeah, exactly. And well, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted your take on something about the Terrence Howard's character, Franklin.
I do want to say Terrence Howard is good in this movie, which is something I almost never say. I do not care for Terrence Howard, but I think he's good in this movie.
Anyway. Yeah, he plays it small and properly.
Yeah, it's fantastic. He's, like, really good in this movie.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with that. But hand in hand with that, I mean, he's playing this kind of meek character. You know, he knows, he eventually finds out or is shown what Keller's doing. You know, he's got this guy who was arrested but freed for lack of evidence, and now he's essentially just torturing them until he can find their children. And he, you know, Franklin is clearly unhappy about this initially. He's very doubtful and does not want to go along with this, but then is kind of goaded into it and then goes along with it for a little while. You know, he's not the one doing the punching, but he's obviously complicit by, you know, helping out in small ways, and most importantly, not going to the police initially. Yeah. But
holding Alex Jones while Keller threatens him with a hammer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just didn't know what you thought about his arc. You know, it kind of reminded me of 12 Angry Men a little bit, which we talked about recently. But there's this person who doubts, and then there's this person who's certain, and the person with the certainty ends up winning out, even though if they both have convictions. Keller just seems so much more sure, and it sways the person on the fence to go one way or the other. In this case, he goes the wrong way, and he eventually tells his wife, and, you know, maybe it's that act of decency that allows him to see his daughter sooner. I just wanted to know what you thought about his role, besides him actually not bothering you as an actor this time around.
Yeah, I mean, he should, like, if we're thinking about this logically, he should be in some sort of legal trouble at the end of this movie, right?
Yeah, we don't know that he's not, but yeah.
That is true, yeah. Well, as soon as they find their kid, they pretty much, him and Viola Davis are basically gone from the movie, because, you know, they're part of the plot is served, and also there's only, like, 15 minutes left. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I didn't think too much about it, just because I guess Hugh Jackman kept screaming at me to think about him. So yeah, I don't have a take on it other than I would imagine Terrence Howard has to go to jail for a little bit.
Yeah. Yes,
but I think you're
not
right.
Forever.
I think you're right, and I think what makes him an interesting character throughout the movie is his unwillingness to sort of partake in what Keller's doing, but also him sort of feeling obligated to help out somebody that or the only person he knows that's in the exact same position that he is in, you know, that's right. Just this, well, outside of both of the wives, who have much smaller parts in this movie. But, Keller is the only person, the only other, I suppose, male in his life that can sympathize with what is going on. Although the way that this town is sold to us, maybe there's 10 other people that he hangs out with, goes bowling with every Wednesday that have similar stories. But I think it's just sort of the just totally unpredictable confusion that you get locked into anytime you're in that sort of situation that, again, I have to guess because I don't even have a child, let alone a kidnapped one. And I think it's just sort of, this is what the other person that's like me is doing. I know this is wrong, but it's better than sitting at home doing nothing. And it's just sort of like, it's a something instead of nothing. Even though he knows it's wrong, he feels like at least he is performing some sort of action, that whether or not it helps lead to the return of his daughter, which it doesn't, which is actually something that I really enjoy about this movie, is that what they do doesn't really do anything. It's just sort of them torturing Alex Jones. It's just the idea of when you're confused, doing something feels better than doing nothing, even if that's something that you're doing really does do nothing. Yeah. Except physically destroy a person.
Well, yeah, it has some effect, just not on you. Yeah, and that was another thing that struck me about looking at this through like an American lens is the morality of torture, which is something that in 2013 hadn't been absolutely blindsided by other things. And the same with Miss Dover's struggle with pills, which sadly is still extremely topical.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we haven't talked about Viola Davis and Maria Bello a lot in this movie just because they're not in this movie a lot. I feel like it is known to listeners of this podcast that we are both very pro Viola Davis. And I think Maria Bello is good in this movie as well, just because I think despite the fact that they don't get a lot of screen time, I think the way that they initially react, where Viola Davis is just totally catatonic and she's like, here are these pictures. I know that you need them, but like, I can't even blink. I'm so in shock. And when Maria Bello is first talking to Loki, her just total denial, just like, this is all going to be so silly when the girls just come home, you know. And I think it's more Maria Bello because we don't really see much progression from Viola Davis, but her progression into that addiction to pills is or presumed addiction to pills is interesting, and another detail of this movie that isn't focused on too closely and thusly becomes a good part of the movie.
Her saying her concern about what the neighbors are going to think of her after this, I think is another thing that so many of the strongest things about this movie are the things that are left to be in the background.
Absolutely. So with that, we will fade into the background of your podcast queue. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and check back next week. We'll be talking about something else.